so big that they wouldn't be able to use the spaceport in Florida. Right now they're leasing Launch Complex 39A. Launch Complex 39A is the one that they launched the Apollo 5 from. They launched all the shuttles, not all, but a lot of the shuttles from Launch Complex 39A. He's now converting it over to launch two different rockets, the Falcon 9 and the Falcon 9 Heavy, which is three Falcon 9s at one time. But this Mars Colonial Transport that he's got plans on building, he's already working on the engines. The engines are called Raptor engines, and it's not like made up. He's got parts being tested by Stennis. Down in Mississippi, the NASA facility, they're actually testing parts for SpaceX for this new engine. But he's got plans on developing Mars Colonial Transport. That with this thing that's so big, he has to build a new launch facility, which he's been doing for quite a few years now. It's at the near Brownsville, Texas. It's roughly in the borderline between Mexico and Texas border. And, if he already says that it's a possibility that the first person that goes to Mars will be launched from Texas. Now, why from Texas? Well, first of all, they need a new spaceport. They need bigger everything to build this thing.
Coming to Buzzard.
He's also headquartered in Texas his main headquarters is in Hawthorne, California, but his headquarters for building or testing all these rockets is in McGregor, Texas. So if he builds these huge rockets, he would be able to bring them over land, nearby, to launch them. To bring these things all the way to Florida, I mean, they're so big, it dwarfs the Falcon 9. It's probably about three times at least in diameter. Falcon 9 is 12 feet in diameter. I think it's around 50 feet in diameter. So he's got plans, multiple shots to orbit. He would put one big rocket up in orbit, and it would sit there. You'd have three or four other launches of similar rockets to refuel this thing. Oh, by the way, all these first stages that are going up, they're going to come back just like the Falcon 9 boosters. They're going to be reusable. And I could go on and on, Dick. I mean, he's got this whole plan of how he's going to get people to Mars and back. These are rough ideas that, I pull out of the air. Different websites, pretty credible websites, but at the same time, he's not going to release a lot of information. They say in September he's going to release some pretty good information on what he plans on doing. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Yeah, let me back up a little bit, Paul. One of the missions you said they're going to try to colonize the moon by dropping down for a couple of days and setting up a temporary or a permanent habitat of some kind. At high noon on the moon, it goes to numbers like 150 centigrade, which is around 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Picture a habitat being bathed at oven temperatures, 300 Fahrenheit. Picture those oxygen bottles at that temperature that are on board. That doesn't sound feasible to me, Paul. By some means, you've got to get that habitat 20 meters below grade where the temperature is more steady. On that surface, the coldness at night and the heat during the day is just out of sight. And I'm not hearing the sound of anybody worrying about that detail. Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
A comment on that, Dick.
Yeah, I might as well let Barry have it. I don't know. I'm not even hearing sounds of when they plan on doing it, or how they're going to get there, or by what rocket. So they're a long way off. I'm saying that's if anything, that's their goal, not Mars. I'll go Barry. Have it back to you. There.
Yeah, Barry. What's your comment on that one, Barry? And wait for the 3 beeps. Before beeps.
I only heard one beep, but I think that's the way it should be at this hour.
Okay, so you have mentioned several times that the ground temperature is several hundred degrees in the sunlight, but there is no atmosphere, or practically none. You know, it's just about none. So if you happen to be not in the sunlight, if you're in a shadow, I think the temperature will drop precipitously. I think like many degrees below zero, just by moving over a foot, you're in a shadow. That's what I'm thinking. Every time you say that, that's the first thought that comes to my mind. So if you just build something over your head so that the direct light from the sun doesn't reach you, maybe something reflective, or maybe something with little tiny holes in it, to let some of the sunlight reach the ground, or something like that, you might bring it back to a usable temperature without digging under the ground in QMB.
Interesting concept, Barry. I hope you're right, but I'm doubtful. I'm a little worried. You've got the sunshade over you, so the sunlight is not directly shining on you, and the sun is not shining directly on the dirt that you're standing on. That helps. But let's assume that sunshade you're under is 10 foot in diameter. So 5 feet in all directions, you come out of the radius of that sunshade, and now that dirt around you is being bathed with sunlight, and that dirt is going up to 300 degrees Fahrenheit. If in all directions around you, there's a 300 degree oven, and you're in this tiny little section that's not getting direct sunlight, I still think by radiation characteristics, T to the fourth emission of that dirt, you're going to experience a lot of heat. But maybe there's a way of designing a real good sunshield. Maybe you've got a doghouse with a mirror on the roof that's reflecting all that sunlight back into the sky. But that's the heat at high noon. At nighttime, the temperature goes down to minus 250 Fahrenheit. That's going to require a huge amount of insulation and a huge amount of heat source of some kind to keep you from freezing. So it's a pretty severe environment. Back to you on that one, Barry. N2 moonbound. K2RIW.
K2RIW.
Antics in waiting.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to turn it back to you, but, you know, things don't weigh much on the moon. The canopy could be much larger. It could be supported by a little simple pole. I mean, it doesn't have to be a big surface structure. There's no wind or anything. If it's there, it's there, and it could be quite large. So, I don't know. And maybe you could bring it right down to the ground on the edges, too. I'm not sure. Just a thought. Back to net control and 2MB mobile.
Yeah, we've got Wes and Eric in that order with a comment on this one. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, you're switching subjects so fast. You were talking about the Mars. 11 years old Ukrainian girl designed a new flying vehicle for Mars called Mars Hopper that made the group of IT students from Zhytomyr Military Institute to win NASA Global Competition Space against American teams and plenty of other scientific teams as well. And this thing can fly about 1,000 kilometers before the refueling, and it's going to refuel itself. That is based on solid form of carbon dioxide gas, which is the dry ice. And the drone project was presented to NASA based on the concept that the dry ice would be melted during the flight using radioisotope thermoelectric generator, which is no energy required because the energy comes from hot radioactive substance, like that. Rapid energy release creates just thrust, so the plane hops from landing to landing, and that's why it's being hopper. So we have a definitely confirmation from NASA of winning project, 11 years old girl, and to
Adrian. Yeah, that's a new one on me. Interesting. That one I haven't heard about.
The email.
I'm going to have to do a little more searching of the emails and or websites on that one. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
All right, I got a two-pointer. One Paul can probably answer is, what's the actual operating range of the spacers that we work with in space? I'm just curious what the range is, because they're either in direct sunlight or they're not in anything, although they're not that high up, so I suspect that there's some attenuation going on. And the other thing is simply, why not just make a giant thermos bottle? Or a thermos bottle within a thermos bottle, and you can pretty much solve the issue as long as you have materials that can deal with the temperature. Don't forget, even after the man landing, we left some stuff behind that transmitted for a while and provided us with seismic information and so on and so forth, and it survived. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, very interesting point. The Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Package, ALSEP package, lasted for a good period of time, like a year or two at least, because I know that on Apollo 16, I listened to those signals that was put on the surface of the moon by either Apollo 11 or 12.
Max was at my hands on one of those power generators.
So somehow that electronic survived those temperatures. So let's see if Paul knows what's the maximum and minimum temperature that a spacesuit can tolerate. I know that Story Musgrave, doing his repair, he was out there for 8 solid hours, and during the nighttime portions of the mission, his hands got so cold that he no longer has feeling in his fingers. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, I know the range is 500 degrees. You know, you need 250 on one side, 250 below zero. That's what's happened to some of them in that environment, you know, in spacewalks. And the same for the moon. But you never read much about the heating system. You know, they have some electric type of heating going on there, you know, where they you need something, but it's the problem of getting rid of the heat inside the spacesuit. It's more of a problem. So that's why they have all these cooling vests. You know, you put on this garment loaded with thousands of these tiny tubes, PVC tubes, and they're all manifolded together, and they're running cooling water. It's a chill water system, really, going through your whole suit. And that's what they worry about. Your body gives up heat, and they can't get rid of the heat. And it's the same thing on the inside of the space station. They're not worried about, you know, putting on a bunch of heating systems. Half the space station is always in shade, and the other half is always in sun most of the time. So now you take, for instance, Apollo 17. It lasted almost 4 days on the surface of the moon, and then, you know, it was 100% daytime. They did fine, so you don't have to worry about daytime. You got to worry more about nighttime. The lander from China that just landed there a couple of years ago, that lasted, through the whole night, and it survived. Let me drop it.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, I timed it out, but the lander from China survived through the night, and even a couple of months later, they were still getting signals back from it. And that, you know, that's not, you're not putting people there at night. You know, having electronics survive is going to be a lot more easy than trying to keep a person warm. But I think if they go up there in the daytime, you've got 2 weeks to develop some kind of habitat. I think they could do that. You know, even if you set some kind of system up in the daytime where you could, you know, one side of the thing is hot and the other side is cool, you know, you could take the heat from one side and transfer it over to the other side. You just can't do that at night. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, sure. How in the world does that electronics of Alpha packages survive those crazy temperatures? Maybe it's not quite as bad as I thought, if you got the right kind of a sun shield on it, so to speak. I know that Joe, W2RYY, wants us to go back to a second subject that he's got. So Joe, W2RYY, go ahead with your question that you mentioned to us earlier, K2RYW and the TechNet.
Okay, very good, W2RYY here. I saw this thing advertised on TV. It's kind of a remarkable little product called a Minimax. And it uses a lithium cobalt battery, as it's called. I just looked this thing up on the web. Found a website for it. The battery inside is a 7,400 milliamp hour battery, so a 7.4 amp hour battery. And it can put out from 200 to 400 amps to start cars, to jump cars with. And I actually saw this demonstrated. They demonstrated this on this infomercial of this guy starting seven cars in a row without batteries in them. It's just kind of amazing you can get that kind of power out of that kind of battery pack and that kind of current available and do it over and over and over again. Have you heard of this product or this technology, Dick? Back to you.
Why do you think these things blow up?
Boy, you create a short circuit on that battery, you're going to get smoke and flames. Wow. If it can do that. I mean, the starting current on an automobile, particularly an automobile that hasn't been run for a while, I think it's a healthy 100 amperes, isn't it, Eric? Have you heard of that one, Eric? I did see the beginning of an advertisement on television of that in the last few days. I didn't see the whole ad. K2EJ, what do you know about that? K2LIW?
How big was that battery, physically? Well, the website is called www.tryminimax.com. www.tryminimax.com. TryMinimax.com. And you can come up, what the website says is it'll supply from 200 to 400 amps of current to start cars. Some diesel engines, of course, it won't start because I guess they draw a lot more current to get a diesel running than a car does. But still, I know what you're saying. It's a lot of current to be pulling out of that or something. And this guy put this thing in his shirt pocket. That's how big the battery is inside this unit. Must have some electronics inside because it can charge computers and other things through USB type cords that can plug into it. And he puts it in the shirt pocket. That's how big. So how big can that be? Not too big.
QAQ with a comment?
I'll take it first.
Joe, you said tryminimax.com. Is that T-R-I or T-R-Y? Back to you, Joe.
T-R-Y. Minimax.com. Go ahead, look it up.
We will. Glenn, go ahead.
Oh, my turn.
First.
I heard Glenn and Eric in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
No, Dick, you're backwards.
You go first.
I will. You asked me if I've seen the ad. Yes, I have. For any of you folks that are going to be in Dayton, you'll find a guy, a man, who's an African American. He runs a kilowatt out of the back of his bicycle. And he uses a couple of lithium polymer batteries that are about a half an inch thick, maybe about 6 inches long, and about 10 inches wide. Here's just four of them. And he runs the damn thing for an hour. You don't realize the power density that there is in the new battery technology. You look at what the man who runs SpaceX is doing in terms of power generation, and the guy who makes the Tesla and the batteries that are being created for that, and the ones in the home, in terms of power density, let me have a drop. The power densities are incredible. As you know, even with a lead acid battery, if you put it dead short of caution, everything's going to melt because it's not designed to pass the amount of current it's capable of creating. Well, the same goes for this lithium series of batteries. I mean, we started out with lithium ion. We've gone now through many different variations of that. Lithium cobalt has more power density than lithium vinyl, lithium polymer. So don't be surprised, but the thing that you'll find interesting about that I keep scratching my head about is the size of the electrodes. If you're going to draw 200 amps, how much actual wire thickness or, you know, how much metal do you need for it to pass through without it vaporizing? All right, K2RW, K2J.
That Minimax lithium cobalt battery that can start all these automobiles and deliver 200 to 100 or 400 amperes for brief periods of time, I presume that's a rechargeable battery. Is that your understanding, Eric? And how often can that thing be recharged? Over to you if you know about that, Eric.
Yes, that is a rechargeable battery. Just as much as the lithium polymer is a rechargeable battery, lithium cobalt is a rechargeable battery. The only series of batteries that have a higher power density that aren't rechargeable in the conventional sense that you put juice back into it is a zinc air battery. It's got like 10 times the power density of what the lithium cobalt battery had at this point. So, yeah, it's rechargeable. And I think the PVA kind of stretches it. So, you know, there's limits. And in terms of the life of the battery, of course, you draw more current from it at a instantaneous period of time. You cause more, let's call it a chemical damage to it without going into the chemistry of it. Whereas if you withdraw it at a constant pace for an extended period of time, you don't do the same type of damage. That's pretty much true of most devices. But, yeah, there you go. K2RW, K2J.
Boy, that sure does sound fantastic. KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, a lot of the comments that I have are basically a lot, Eric pretty much covered most of them. The only things I can probably round out about that is that, you know, as you're going from the lead acid chemistry to nickel metal hydride, the impedance of the battery is going to be roughly about a third of the impedance of lead acid. When you go to the lithium ion and its family of chemistries, basically you're talking about something that's almost a tenth of the impedance of lead acid. So as the impedance of that battery is dropping, amount of current that you can pull out instantaneously is very, very high. But there again, there's a price that you pay, as Eric says. You pull out a very, very fast current density on a small volume of battery, it reduces the life. Also, the charging is also a lot more complicated. The balancing between the cells, although the cell voltage in the lithium family of batteries is much higher than that of a lead-acid cell, basically what's happening is that you have to be very, very careful about controlling each individual cell to make sure that they charge evenly and they don't imbalance, which also adds to complexity, cost, and weight. So there's a lot of little playoffs in there with the batteries. But yeah, it's really possible to use lithium ion or any of its families to start a car. Not a problem at all, Dick. K2RW, K2QIQ.
Yeah, just to add to that, if you think of any lithium-type battery that you have, it's usually a little microprocessor. You know, it's a single chip in it that manages the battery because you need it.
Yeah, the chip makes sure you don't overcharge it and you don't undercharge it, under-discharge it, over-discharge it. That's what that chip is doing. But I don't think that chip can protect you from a short circuit. If I've got a battery capable of being connected with great big bare clips across the two terminals of my car battery, and my car battery is essentially dead, and I want to start that starter motor. If it's capable of issuing that kind of current, And every so often a person makes a mistake and touches those two clips together by mistake. What would happen with that lithium, lithium cobalt battery? What would happen to that battery if I, for a short period of time, touch those two leads together? What do you think, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
WS2N. It looks like it's got a fuse on it, though.
Well, I've not taken this device apart, but I will tell you this much. If you think about the hoverboards and the flames that they make, and you think about some of these vape pens that explode in people's pockets because they're fluids and the battery short together, you have a tremendous amount of current available. I mean, what's the difference between taking, like, a 10-farad capacitor, you know, and charging it up and discharging it at a high rate into a motor or a particular voltage? I would suspect in this device that they're selling, that there's got to be a fuse there. Otherwise, we're looking at flames. We're not just talking about smoke here. K2RWK2J.
Yeah, I just decided to go to that website, and I haven't seen the thing yet, but wow. Three payments of $33 will cost you $100. And I think you're saying, Paul, you see a fuse on it somewhere, so in theory it's protected from a short circuit, and I guess that fuse is a replaceable item. WS2N, K2RIW.
I saw it in the video that I just watched, but it looks like this fuse or whatever, it's probably encapsulated. It looks like it's very hard to get out, but who knows, maybe it's a fusible link, although that would make it useless. It looks like it's flat, so maybe it's a spade type of fuse, automotive fuse. I'm going to guess it's probably that. Back to you.
Yeah, that could be a thermal breaker. By the way, how big are the wires coming out of this thing?
It looks like 12 gauge. It doesn't look thick enough.
Maybe the thing is used to put a charge into your battery that then charges the starter. That would be a little bit more reasonable. What do you think?
On the TV ad, they show you, they clip it on, the guy turns the key, the thing starts. Whether it's true or not, that's whatever the story is.
They jumped it without the battery in the car.
Wow. So you can start six cars in a row, and this thing will fit into your shirt pocket. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
That's what they're saying. Well, look, I mean, the reality is, I have a hybrid vehicle, okay? It uses a motor. Not a starter motor, a conventional sense. This vehicle starts in 750 milliseconds. But it uses a high voltage to do it. But the reality of today's engines in terms of the ability to turn it over, because I can remember working on cars even when I was a kid back in the late 60s, early 70s. Starter motors, without even a load on them, would draw like 35, 40 amps just by themselves just to get them going. But today's vehicles, you know, if we had to crank start them, it would be so easy compared to what it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. I mean, the way the bearings are made, the way new engines are made, they have a lot less friction than the old ones do. So, you know, I could see them picking a car that's really low current in terms of starting it and using this thing as part of an edge.
Boy, that sounds too good to be true. And the lithium chemistry you know of, Eric, and there's lithium ferrite, and there's lithium cobalt, lithium polymer, and so on, so darn many of them. Are all of them capable of being charged, recharged hundreds of times? Is there a definite wear-out characteristic that you know about? Over to you, Eric.
The best example I can give you, do you happen to own any Sony products that run with lithium-ion batteries? There will be a charge counter and a rate meter for each battery, and within each battery is the controller and a little bit of smarts to keep track of it. Lithium-ion batteries have a very definitive life and a definitive number of times you can charge them and get full efficiency out of them.
You can charge them. I mean, they don't ever die. One of the nice things about lithium-ion batteries is that you can charge them up, put them on the shelf, come back 6 months later, and you've got exactly the same charge on. Or damn near close. They have an incredible shelf life. They don't degrade like nickel metal hydride or nickel cadmium, for that matter. You know, there's a lot of nice characteristics about it, but yeah, let me let it drop. A definitive life cycle to the type of chemistry. There are differences between the chemistry. I did some reading on the lithium cobalt a couple of weeks ago, as a matter of fact. It adds all the different materials that they've used. By far, this one's the most forgiving, or the most resilient, however you want to look at it, in terms of its life and its charge cycle life. But now, listening to this conversation, I have to go back and look at it in terms of how does it survive, you know, large instantaneous discharges over a period of time, what does it do to it, the chemistry. QTRW, can you do it again?
QIQ with one more comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Technology on these batteries is really going pretty far. So the charge and discharges with the right circuitry, you could actually really get these batteries to last a fairly good amount of time. If you look at the way laptops and your handhelds are all working today, the batteries are getting really small and they're lasting quite a while. So the technology is moving in the right direction in terms of quick charges and discharges and all kinds of good stuff. But the one thing that they haven't resolved yet, let me let it drop. The one still main problem is high temperature, rapid temperature pressure change. And that's why one of the reasons that the FAA does not want you holding electronic devices in your hands or laptops on your lap. They want them stowed away during takeoff and landing, because if the cabin pressure ever gets lost during a takeoff or during a landing, you could be holding a bomb in your hand.
I got another comment.
You got it, Eric.
The one thing that's in common with all this lithium chemistry, and that's why the airlines are really all upset about it, is that the primary factor of moving electrons is by the generation of hydrogen. Now, in the process of discharge, under normal controlled circumstances, the hydrogen ions never get the opportunity to become a gas. And, you know, they're absorbed in the next layer. The way these batteries work are a little bit complicated. There's some big differences between the types of chemistry and how they're physically put together. So, the early run of lithium polymer batteries, which is in a lot of laptops and cell phones, the issue that Judge Graham was just talking about is very real. The later versions of stuff that's been out to the past couple of years now don't have as much of an issue with that. But there is still always a danger of rapid discharge by having some malfunction. You get two things. You get a lot of heat burst and a lot of hydrogen building up, and the two don't like each other. QTRW, KHRPJ.
I forget who was telling me this in the last week, that you do not start charge lithium batteries fully charged and leave them that way for a long period of time. They're supposed to be slowly, they're supposed to be discharged a certain amount if you're going to store them for a long period of time. Some form of destructive process, or
say by half.
So you're supposed to charge them to half for a long period of time for storage. What do you believe is the failure mechanism if you leave them fully charged for a long period of time, Eric? Go ahead.
The process is similar, but it's different in each type of chemistry. You can think of it, the easiest way of thinking about it, come back to thinking about lead-acid batteries and think about sulfating your plates. Something similar to that, but it really doesn't happen in the same form. Because when you actually go and discharge it, you move the ions across, but not all of them, because some of them are stuck where they started. So that's just the simplest way I can explain it.
Contact failure, Dick, it's basically, as Eric was stating, that right at the contacts where the battery is what fails.
So if you leave it fully charged, it somehow eats up its contacts, is that what saying, Glenn?
Pretty much.
If I treat a lithium-like battery, and there's all kinds of lithiums, if I treat it with tender loving care, can I go from...
It'll last forever.
I was about to ask you, can I go from full charge down to, let me pick a number, 30% charge, and maybe you're not supposed to go below that number. Can I go from full to 30? Can I do that 500 times? Over to you, Eric. Yeah, Eric.
Absolutely. If you take care of your lithium ion battery, they're the most common thing. Then you charge them carefully at the proper intervals, and you store them properly, you'll get life out of them like you wouldn't believe.
Now, if I want maximum life out of the battery, in the case of your electric automobile, that system has the ability to charge that battery all the way. I think yours is a hybrid. So because it's a hybrid, it doesn't need to charge it all the way. However, if I wanted to get maximum range out of my thoroughly electric car that's not a hybrid, I would tend to charge it all the way up to the tippy top. And then if the trip I was about to go on gets canceled, and I leave it there for a week, that doesn't sound good. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
All right, let me point something out. You're buying a vehicle for X number of tens of thousands of dollars, okay? I don't know if you've actually looked into the extent of electronics in vehicles today. It's just absolutely incredible. It's like a spaceship. Those types of things that you can think of, I've been, like, invited to Ford when I bought this thing, and I got to sit down with a couple of their engineers. They come up with every possible scenario you could possibly think of. I don't know how they do it, but they do it. But the amount of smarts that's in these vehicles will manage the batteries, manage the charge cycle, manage the discharge cycle. If it sees that it's holding too much charge, it will actually burn some of it off. So, you know, we're talking about something expensive like that when the minute drops. You would hope and pray that the engineers who put it together thought about things like that. So you can ask a question like that, and they'll say, yeah, here's the answer. When it comes to smaller consumer-type items, and I'm not necessarily talking about laptops, because there's a different kind of engineering thinking that goes in making that, as opposed to, say, a piece of video equipment or an MP3 player. From the battery manufacturer, there will be a specific chip that's recommended that you use this thing with, where you cannot overcharge it. You cannot undercharge it. It will simply shut off and say, bye, charge me up. You'll find that in all your higher-end stuff like laptops and things like that. So if you're talking about an engineered product, you don't really have to worry about stuff like that. If you're just, you know, Joe Ham and he got himself a little lithium polymer flap, you better be careful and do things right. Otherwise, you may have some fire on your hands. K2RAW, K2J.
It's 2QAQ.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just interesting that, you know, if you look at the chemistry, and just like Eric said, if you hold the battery within all of its correct parameters, it'll last a real long time. But when you look at the number of components and do regular failure analysis on all the electronics, the MTBF of the electronics is far lower than the actual battery chemistry itself. So right now, the real thing that limits the life of the battery is the electronics to charge and discharge. K2QIQ.
I get the impression that most of the portable operating devices that we put our hands on have a chip in there to make sure you don't overcharge or undercharge, make sure you don't charge at too high a rate. I'm guessing it gives those kind of protections. The really high energy batteries that are used on electrically powered radio control aircraft has no chip in it. And those batteries are being charged raw, hopefully by an intelligent charger. However, when you're at one of those events, let me drop them. They strongly influence you to encourage you to put the battery into something that looks like an ammo case when you're charging it. And one of the modes of failure that those batteries sometimes go into is where they start puffing out, in which case you're supposed to throw them away. You're supposed to discard them in a safe way. When they start becoming puffy, I think you're supposed to stop using them.
I'm guessing the puffiness is because of some kind of internal outgassing because of overcharging. Is that a good guess to Eric, KE2EJ, KQLAW?
Yeah, let me be perfectly honest with you. I'm not familiar with those particular batteries. I've actually wondered about them because I've got a couple of projects I want to put together. I've been looking at what the IC world has to offer. But I would suspect that that would be the case, is that when you overcharge them, not only do they get hot, but they generate hydrogen gas. And if it's in a sealed container, like anything else, built from pressure up, the wicked parts kind of start molten.
Is it 2QIQ?
Go ahead.
If you look at a lot of these battery packs and how they're actually assembled, they're basically individual cells all packed together to get the appropriate voltage. Typically the center voltage is somewhere like around 1.2 to 1.3 volts, and you stack them to get the voltage that you need. The reason that they start bulging is because what happens, because of charging and discharging randomly, what starts happening is one cell in the middle becomes the weak sister, so to speak. So instead of them being individually charged at each individual cell level, what's happening is you're getting an imbalance between which cell is being charged. So what you're seeing, the bulging, is the weak sister in the middle that starts to fail first, and that's a good time to stop using that battery. Case 2QIQ.
Question, Dick.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I gather, those individual 1.25 volt cells that are usually shrink wrapped, shrink tubing put together.
Yeah, that's the typical RC type of stuff. Yeah. back to Dick, K2RW, case 2QIQ.
Yeah, John recognized, but I got a quick question first, and that is, piece of information I'm going to give you. Each of these batteries that are used on radio-controlled aircraft have an individual lead for each individual cell for monitoring during the charging process. So the so-called smart charger tries to make sure that each one of the cells gets equal charge. So some of that gets avoided. But I know that they occasionally become puffy. You would think with a smart charger that wouldn't happen. Also, the lithium batteries that were a few cubic inches that are used on these handheld products that I was associated with, they had a great big rack in that factory which was charging maybe 20 or 30 of these batteries all at once. And one of those batteries started outgassing, went into some kind of a failure mode on that charger. Maybe they overreacted, but they dumped out every human...
Repeater, timeout.
When that one battery started outgassing, they evacuated that whole building. 1,000 people had to leave that building for a couple of hours until they corrected that condition. As I said, I don't know if they overreacted, and the outgassing gases, are they somehow very toxic to your knowledge? Eric, go ahead.
Hydrogen, Dick.
Yes, as far as I'm aware, there's a number of agents that are there that are not pleasant to breathe in. And the other major component is hydrogen. So you have the explosion process beyond the toxicity of it. And you'll find that the battery packs that look like they're flat, square, and rectangular, as opposed to like a AA battery type of shape. The AA battery type shape things are a traditional lithium lithium ion. The little flat ones, those are lithium polymer.
And when it comes back to you, I'm going to ask you what's the real difference of those chemistries. Let's go to John first. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, got a quick question here in the in Echolink. A gentleman named Nick would like to know, if you're going to put a battery into storage, a lead-acid battery, what charge level should it be at when you put it in, if you know? Back to you, KC2WGB.
Electrolyte. Yeah, give us some words on that. Very few people are going to take the electrolyte out of a lead-acid battery. If there were a recommended percentage of charge, you should bring a lead-acid battery too, if you're going to leave it on the shelf for 2 months. What do you think, Eric?
Now, again, that kind of depends. Are we talking a traditional lead-acid battery? Are we talking a gel cell? What are we talking here?
Traditional lead-acid.
Well, it could be a marine deep discharge type, it could be a conventional lead acid, or it could be a gel cell. Give us all three answers, Eric, go ahead.
ultimately, you put a smart charge on it, keep it hooked up. You know that when you discharge lead acid batteries, you've moved the lead into lead sulfate, and that remains there for a long time, especially immersed in liquid. It just prevents you from charging the battery up to where it belongs again. Depends on the manufacturer. Some manufacturers say 60%. I know some other people say 70%. There's another one that recommends even higher values. But lead acid battery, the best way to preserve them is dump the electrolyte for life. Nothing changes.
I can see that. And some of these chargers are so-called float charger, which essentially keeps the battery at near 100% forever. And I wonder if that's destructive. An awful lot of these emergency lighting in buildings are floating that lead acid battery, or is it a gel cell? And when it comes to discharging a lead acid battery, gel cell or lead acid, I think you're never supposed to discharge it all the way. I mean, what's the number you're supposed to go down to? No more than 20%? You go down to the 20% point, don't go beyond it. Is there a magic number like that you know about, Eric? K2EJ, K2RAW?
You know, it's funny because it really depends upon the battery manufacturer. Some of them use honeycomb plates, some of them use the striping structure, which prevents sulfation. But in general, you don't want to discharge a lead acid battery lower than 60%, because then you start running into trouble. Deep discharge marine batteries, those things are cool. I mean, you see the way they're made. They're also a lot heavier in some respects. They're more interesting, but you can actually discharge them down to 10-5%, not really damage them. Any more than that, you're going to kill them. They have a real fast living and death point. You know, you exceed that point and you'll be very sorry.
So even a deep discharge means you can go to a smaller percentage of rate of discharge, but you still can't go all the way down to the bottom. I know I once took one of my gel cell type flashlights, and I wanted to find out how long it was really good for, and I discharged it all the way. Boy, I had a hell of a time trying to get a charge back into that battery. And so I'm pretty sure that that particular gel cell was probably down to 30% performance for the rest of its life. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
No, gel cells are a way of, you know, putting a compact amount of energy into a smaller space. If you look at the power densities of gel cells versus the traditional lead acid battery, you can see the difference in volume this makes. It also means that gel cells really rot in terms of life and age. You know, you can't expect more than a year or two out of a gel cell that's got a floating charge on it. They just naturally sulfate just from the physical methodology in which they're put together. And don't forget, the sulfuric acid is encased in this gooey stuff that doesn't allow for it to just freely move around and allow the particles that do solidify in the process of charging and discharging to change its position. They kind of like stay frozen in time. They get in the way. So, you know, that's why emergency lights are supposed to be have your batteries replaced every year. K2RAW, K2EJ.
K2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, flow charge for almost any battery isn't a good thing. It's one of those things that you really only want to flow charge when things get very cold. So when you look at a battery's temperature characteristic, it's going to drop below a certain temperature. When your temperatures start going below what's called the normal shelf temperature, what you want to do is have some kind of thermostatic control that starts a charger up that basically holds a charge on the battery. So you want to kind of do that. But when the temperature comes back up within range again, you want to basically turn off that popping charge. So a lot of it really depends on the ambient conditions, Nick. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, if I started off with a lead-acid battery that's near fully charged, and this is wintertime, and I store it outside at 20 degree Fahrenheit weather for a few months, and I'm starting off fully charged, but I'm not putting a float charger on it, is that process I just described destructive? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, because if you're not careful and you don't check on that battery every once in a while and see what state it's actually in, it could actually kill it by spring. You might not have a battery anymore.
In other words, it might go into a self-discharge below the critical point.
Yeah, it's pretty safe to assume, Dick. KC2QIQ.
You would think if the battery is being stored cold, that the rate of self-discharge would be decreased. I mean, all chemical reactions go down to half rate every time you go down 10 degrees centigrade. So you would like to believe that the rate of self-discharge would be minimized when it's in a cold environment. So that sounds kind of opposite, doesn't it?
Well, what's the impedance when it's cold? What's the impedance when it's hot?
Well, let me explain that one a little bit in better detail. If you look at batteries, you can get battery curves on them and see where they start. There's a point to which what you're saying is actually true. There is a temperature where the battery will pretty much hold a charge for a real, real, real long time. And it diminishes when you go too hot, where you have to make sure that the charging voltage or the top-off voltage is a little, you have to take some out a little bit for it to last. And when you go cold, it'll stay at a charge for a real long time. But if you get really cold, it starts, you know, losing life. And if it freezes, the battery's done. KC2QIQ.
What you were discussing there, Eric, is that the equivalent series resistance becomes pretty high if the battery is cold. Yeah, I think cold cranking is a problem. In other words, in cold weather, you might not be able to develop the 200 amperes you need for your charger, for your starter motor. Isn't that approximately true? Over to you, Eric.
Which actually brings me to the point that Eric's going to mention anyway. Think about what happens molecularly when things get cold. What happens to chemical reactions? And just to throw in for a different chemistry, like carbon batteries, throw them in the refrigerator, you can extend their shelf life for years and years. Throw them in the freezer, and you can throw them in the garbage. The actual conductivity, or the rate at which the movement of electrons happens through this physical medium, don't forget we're talking about a chemical reaction as far as making making a transfer from chemistry to electrical energy. The colder it gets, the slower things happen. But there are different physical properties in the actual physical chemical reaction at different temperatures in terms of how much material gets deposited, moved from one place to the other, and how they actually form and build up. Do they build up uniformly? Do they build up in dots? Does it look like a matrix? There's a few things to think about here, Dick.
One of the really bad things that happens to a lead-acid battery is called being sulfated. Now, what are the conditions that give me a sulfated battery? Too deep a discharge and left into discharge mode for too long a period of time? And sulfated, does that mean there's a coating of sulfurous material on the plate that's acting as an insulator? And is that the reason why it won't accept the charge until you go to a very high voltage and burn through that? Give me some words on what sulfating really means and what's the major cause of it. And if I'm floating a battery and I'm continuously charging it, does that also sulfate it? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
W2RAY.
Okay. Now, let me tell you first. All right, let's you have to start at the beginning if you really want to explain that. Okay. Let me go to the corner. You have two plates, right? One is actually both made of lead. One is a spongy type of lead. One is a particularly hard form of lead. And you have an electrolyte that is made of water and hydrogen sulfide. Actually, it's sulfuric acid. H2SO4. So you have this component that's water and sulfur, which is the electrolyte. Now, sulfur itself, if you look up its conductivity, I think it's a pretty resistant material. What you're doing is you're going from one plate, which is basically lead sulfate, and you're moving the sulfate from one set of plates over to the pristine lead plates, which have this sponginess to it, so the sulfur that gets deposited on the other plate in the process of moving electrons actually fills up the little sponginess in those holes. Now, as the battery is normally going through a charge and discharge cycle, that material is constantly moving back and forth, and it never kind of like gets an opportunity to stay in one place and become all connected to itself and become very hardened when it drops. So at the point that you've discharged it and you've moved all the sulfur over to the spongy lead plate, it's now sitting there, and if it's sitting there for weeks, it becomes a very, very hard, thin layer of material in which electrons do not want to pass. KQIW, KJJ.
My experience is, though, if I raise the voltage high enough, I'll eventually get it to the point where it starts accepting a charge. And by burning through that sulfurous insulated layer, and when I now fully charge that battery, do I eventually bring it almost back to where it used to be, or is there going to be some of that sulfur stuck in that sponge, and I'm never going to get the full surface area of the sponge back again? Over to you, Eric, KQRAW.
Now, let's assume that you're a high-quality organization that wants the maximum life out of your battery, so you're going to build a battery case out of something that's in a, like, glass. Actually, you'll find railroad batteries, you'll find in the old days of copper telephones and in telephone offices, or even in home off-the-grid energy systems, you'll find the batteries that are built in these glass aquarium cages, literally, if you want to call them that, so. And if you start off with plates that are absolutely pure and lead without any impurities, and you start off with distilled water and really pure hydrochloric acid, you can really deep discharge them and then whack them and bring them back to their full state. The failure mechanism in the process of that is going to be heat. Because as you start to break through that layer, you're going to be generating a lot of heat. Generating quite a bit of hydrogen that's going to be released, because not all of it's going to become hydrochloric acid and then back onto the other plate. So there's going to be some transfer loss going on there. But in essence, what you're saying is true. If you have a completely controlled environment, you can do that. Add some impurities in the mix and you reduce the possibility of that.
Is the electrolyte hydrochloric acid or sulfuric acid?
If I said hydrochloric, I'm sorry, it's sulfuric acid. We're talking about sulfides, not chlorides.
I kind of thought so. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-A-W, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, Dick, I'm not sure what you're looking for, but you're looking for something to keep, like, the batteries on a generator up to snuff all the time, so you don't have to worry about it, whether it gets hot, cold, or whatever. I would suggest using something like what's called a battery tender, and I'll tell you what, they work very, very well. I have two of them. I use one on my motorcycle, and I use one for my lawnmower battery. Lawnmower battery is about 10 years old. The motorcycle battery is about 5 years old. Before that, I would change the motorcycle battery every 2 years. With a regular car charger, it would kill them. Since I use a battery tender, I've had six years of the motorcycle battery, and it still works great. They don't overcharge it, they don't overdo it, they keep the thing right up to the right level, and they work great. They'll work on car batteries, work on small batteries, whatever you put on that's 12 volts, they don't care, they work great.
So it sounds like this battery tender is something with a real lot of intelligence. I'm getting the impression it carefully monitors the voltage on the battery.
It measures the impedance of the battery.
I'm guessing it carefully measures the temperature of the environment, and therefore it is floating the battery at some magic number which doesn't overcharge it, doesn't over-discharge it. So that battery tender does all of those things. Is that roughly true, John? Here we go. Joe, and I buy it from where, and how many dollars is this battery tender? W-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-A-W.
I do not know if it monitors the temperature. It
possibly may do that internally within the case itself. Just go on Google and put battery tender. You'll, I'm